pool is his grandson Rashbam, this little source here. It sat in a jar for about 800 years until a man named Rosen in the middle of the 19th century put it to print. It was not in the Mikros Gedolos all those years. And there are some other French commentaries that have never been placed in Mikros Gedolos, even in the latest Mosad Hara Kook Mikros Gedolos. They are, we'll learn all about these guys in the next few weeks, but Yosef Bechor Shor, Chizkuni, these are all students and chaverim of the next two or three generations after Rashi. There's Hadar Zakenim, there's the Das Zakenim, Ibali HaTosfos. That commentary was incorporated into the Mikros Gedolos. There is a new Perush that was just printed this past year. It was a doctoral thesis of Mitchell Orlean. That's the next one.
Mitchell? Dr. Mitchell?
Dr. Orlean. Oh. Yeah, he's been teaching
in
the square for many years.
Oh, I had to be fantastic.
Okay, so this is called Sefer Hagan. You'll see it also from the same school. Actually, the Rashbam was a doctoral thesis of a scholar in Canada. His name is Martin Lokshin. We'll be studying all these in the next few weeks. It's translated. This is Rashbam to Bereshis in translation. Now you get a doctoral thesis for a translation of one sefer, but all right. It works.
Quite visual, you do it, Rama.
So, but he is indeed a great scholar. And what I wanted to today is to discuss some of the continued discussing, as we started last week, some of the programmatic differences between Rashi and these other commentaries. So, to start with, it would seem that if Rashi was of this generation that basically introduced the world to the amazing new concept of pshat, of the simple way to read Bible. Remember, the concept Ein Mikra Yotzei Midi Pshuto on 5,422 pages of Talmud appears all of three times. The rabbis were not sensitive to pshat. They were much more sensitive to drash. So I want to give you we've been starting to do with underlying Rashi. But just in this week's parsha, I want to give you some different approaches between Rashbam and Rashi, these two schools. Again, these two people did not introduce or invent these two schools. They seem to exist between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, and 1,000 years before, between rabbinic approaches to the Bible, already as it's seen in the Talmud. But what I'd like to do is through these sheets I've given you here, and some extra material that I'll be doing on the board. And I'd like to do some right here on this board right now. Let's start from a pasuk in Leit Midrash. It says, Vashem Pakad Es Sara Kasher Amar. Right? First pasuk in the Rosh Hashanah Torah reading, and it's in the liturgy of Rosh Hashanah. Vayas Hashem Yisara Ka'asher Diber. Right? God remembered Sarah as he had said, and God did to Sarah as he had spoken. Right? Now, you can read this and see this is the beautiful prose of Torah. This is the way Torah talks. Right? What is a Rashi kind of way to read these two statements? Now that we've been doing this for some time. This is your first class, you may not get it yet. But Vashem Pakad Esara Kasher Amar, Vayas Hashem Vesara Kasher Diber. This is Bereshis Perek Chavaleth Pasuk Aleph.
There's obviously a reason why he's it's being said first Pakad and then Vayas, that making the differentiation. Why is Hashem first taking account of or remembering, and then, you know, as he said, and then speaking, you know, as he spoke.
In essence, what you're telling us is, tell me if everyone here agrees, that according to Rashi, there are two different things that Hashem spoke about here. This is referring to two separate things that Hashem did for Sarah. Right? Rashbam here sees a statement that is just repetition. It's just a beautiful poetry of Torah to take a statement and say the same statement in two different ways, or to be to elaborate a bit. Okay, this is the way the Torah talks. Hashem remembered Sarah as he said. thereby doing to her what he had spoken. Right? Look, I gave you perhaps a more radical example from Parshas, I'll go on this board this time, from Parshas Vayeshev. Remember it said, Vayafshitu es Yosef es kutanto. Remember that? Vayafshitu es Yosef. They stripped Yosef of his tunic. Es ksones hapasim asher alav. Right? They stripped Yosef of his tunic, the long-sleeved or striped tunic that he was wearing. Now, you see, Rashbam listens to these words and says, okay, this is the beauty of Torah. This is how the Torah talks. Hear it again. Vayavshitu et Yosef et kutanto. They stripped Yosef of his tunic, et ktona tapasim asher alav, the long-sleeved tunic that he was wearing. Now, you see extra words there, don't you? The pasuk could just have said, Vayavshitu et Yosef et ktona tapasim asher alav. It skips some words there. So what does someone like Rashi say? Talk to me here. It must be two separate garments that they stripped him of. First they stripped him of an outer jacket, and then the ktona tapasim under that. Right?
Why would we need to know that?
Yosef was walking with it could be that Yosef was glorifying in his coat and walking around so proud of it, or that he always covered it. He was, you know, he was protecting from that type of glory. I don't know. I'm just trying to make up something right on the spot. But what it is that there is a definitive Rashi and Rashbam way of reading psukim like this. So we see in this just nothing but a mere repetition, Rashbam, Radak, sometimes Ibn Ezra, or do we have to make something out of each statement? The case we did last week, if you recall, was Viloasu kasher deber alehen melech Mitzrayim. The women did not do as the king of Egypt said, but techayena es hayeladim. Rashbam, they let the boys live. Rashi, they fed the boys, they gave them food, they helped the mothers. Rashi, where did you get that? Where did you get that?
The second part already is not necessary.
Right, because the second part wasn't necessary. It says they did not listen to Paro. What did Paro tell them to do?
To kill them.
Kill the boys. So when they didn't listen to Paro, what do I hear from that?
They let them live.
They let the boys live. So why does the pasuk have to tell me again they let the boys live? If it's not to tell me that they did something in addition to letting the boys live, namely, they fed them, they helped them, they gave mothers food. So this is basically the underlying difference between the Rashi way to read text and Rashbam way to read text. And, you know, I think that if I asked you here in this room, where do you fall in between these two? It might depend on the example. Right? Some examples you feel that Rashi is more correct. Some examples you might feel that the Rashbam way is more correct. We'll see if there is a rule and a principle at work here, or whether each text deserves to be analyzed on its own. Let's look now at some cases in our parsha. There are some statements that Rashi makes in the preparation of the marriage of Yitzchak to Rivka that are too fanciful. They're too flighty. I mean, it's just. Where does Rashi get this from? So to start to answer that question, I want you to review. Let's look at page 1 of what I'm just handing. Okay. As I said a few weeks ago, this is considered by many scholars to be Rashi's introduction to the Torah. Ibn Ezra wrote a 10-page introduction. What's my commentary like? He writes five things his commentary is not, then he writes five things his commentary is. Right? It's a large, large introduction. Rashi didn't need an introduction. Just start to read his parish, you'll see what it's about. Rashi, however, some scholars say, introduced his parish with this statement, source number 2 on these pages. The problem in the pasuk is that the voice of God, the English translation uses the word, what's the verb for what the voice of God does? It is moving in the garden, right? You hear it? This is the second line. What's the Hebrew word for moving here?
Mitalech.
Rashi's problem is that the verb hey lamed chof, to walk, should not define a voice. Because if you want a hey lamed chof, you must have
legs.
Legs, good. They're legs. A voice does not mitalech. A voice should be mirach. Efes, isoch hagan. Right? There are many Hebrew words to use before you use the word mitalech. Now, Rashi, please, don't you even know that the Bible is idiomatic? Come on, you never heard of a pasuk and 1,000 like them in the Bible? Life and death is in the hands of the tongue, right? What's the problem with that pasuk? Tongue doesn't have a hand. So Rashi, come on, the Bible is idiomatic. Mitalech b'sochagan is not really a problem, right? But still, look what he writes in source number 2. Says Yesh Midrashei Agadah Rabbeinu Kfar Sidru Rabotenu Al Mechonam Bereishit Rabbah Uvishar Midrashot. Says there are a lot of midrashim about this. He doesn't even tell you one of them, because he knows that mitalech can refer to a voice. But he, for some reason, he chooses this pasuk to tell us what his agenda is, and this is it. Look at this. Five little lines in this text, in this source right here. See this? These next five words, the simplicity of Rashi, which made him so popular. Va'ani lo bati ela, now just four lines. Lipshuto shel mikra, to give the plain meaning of scripture. Ula agada ha-miyashevet. The important word here is miyashevet. I will introduce agada, right? We all know what that is by now. Which serves to clarify, ha-miyashevet, to appease, to take a mikra shetzarich yishuv. Right? Remember the example I gave, I think, 2 weeks ago of Bircho Shadayim Berechem, because Rashi saw that in all other places in Tanakh, Berechem comes before Shadayim, and therefore he explained the words so far out of its pshat. Remember that? So he says, I'll do pshuto shel mikra, ula agadah miyashevis divrei mikra, until... Now, I would have preferred if this text, this is the Metzuda text, had given you the real source of the next four words. You see it says, davar, davur, al ofanav. You see that? What's the modern word ofnayim? What is an ofnayim?
Bicycle.
A bicycle, because it has wheels. Davor devor ofnav means my perush will be like two synchronized wheels spinning in tandem. The four words of Rashi did not make up. These are four words in Mishle. The word Mishle, when you hear something that makes sense to you, it is a davor davor al ofnav. Is a word that moves well. It fits these words. In other words, you may not think that what I'm saying is pshat. You may think that what I'm writing is even a fairy tale of rocks fighting under Yaakov's head. But when you read it, you must admit that it fits the words that are written in the Torah. In other words, what Rashi's saying with these few words is, the Torah asks to be darshaned. The first word in the Torah asks to be darshaned. It should not have been Darashis, it should have been... If it means in the beginning. Right? The very first word of the Torah establishes to the Jewish reader, Rashi says, that I want to be darshan. I don't want to limit my understanding to the realm of pshat. But what would you admit and agree that based on Rashi in source number 2, that Rashi prefers pshat over drash? He does not resort to drash until someone just finished the sentence the way you'd like. He does not resort to drash until...
You need to clarify something.
Unless he's forced to, unless he has exhausted all possible approaches of pshat. Okay, now I'll test you, if you agree. In this week's parsha, listen to some of these examples, please. This is amazing. Says that Avram sends his servant. The servant is never named. Rashi assumes it's Eliezer. Fine, it's fair enough, because earlier Avram said, my servant Eliezer is inheriting me. Remember in chapter 15? And in this week's parasha it says, Avram sent his servant who was in charge of his entire household, Moshel B'chola Shalo Zekan Beisov. Never mentions his name, I don't know why, but all right, fair enough. It just calls him Ha'eved, Ha'eved, Ha'eved. And then after he comes up with this amazing plan to get a wife, all of a sudden the Bible calls him Ish. He's never not called Eved anymore. Ah. Okay, so let me get this thing. But put that aside right now. He makes a plan with God. The Talmud is actually not happy with the plan. The Talmud thought that it smacked of nichush, it smacked of superstition. what happens if Canaanites would have done these things. Remember, Shlosha Shalu, Shalokha Hogan, Gemara in the beginning of Titus. I put that aside also. He makes up this deal, right? And he says to God, the first girl that offers me and my camels. Now, what did he do after that? Did he announce to a bunch of women at the well, who has water for me? No, what did he do?
Just immediately.
He went to, not only did he pick that girl, who ended up being Rivka, he ran to her. Vayorots, he ran to that one and asked that one. He didn't give everybody else a chance at being the wife of Yitzchak. He ran to that one and hit on the right girl, the first one. So Rashi says, why did he run to her? Anyone know the Rashi? Because the water ran up out of the well into her tail. Now Rashi does says this about four people in the Rashi. He already said it about Avraham. He says about Avraham, Rachel, Yaakov, and Moshe. So the water rose. Is it out of the well into her tail? Now Rashi, two things I have a problem with here. One, who are you writing for? We're adults here. Right? I must tell you that even if there was a pasuk that said water rose out of the well into her pail, I assure you, Perushim like Sajagon, Ibn Ezra, Rambam and the Morna Buchim, Radak, and a whole slew of Sephardic Parshanim, I'm already preparing you for next month, a whole slew of Sephardic Parshanim would have said that is not to be taken literally. Miracles like that don't happen. Even if the miracle had been written in the Torah. Talk to me. Where does it say it's animals are talking to human beings? And in each case, Ibn Ezra and those Sephardic Mepharshim say no such thing. Animals don't talk.
Bilam.
Not even when the Torah says so. Bilam, the snake in the garden. So even if the text had said that water did that, there would be. I'm telling you, there would be some rationalist Sephardic commentaries who would read into that as some kind of metaphor of sorts. So Rashi, where do you see in the pasuk that water is rising out of the well into a pail? Right? Now, I want to make sure that we don't get the wrong impression and use circular reasoning in Parshanut. You see, if you asked Rashi, why did he run to her? The correct answer is because he saw, according to Rashi, because he saw water rise into the pail. But there's a more important question to ask. Where did Rashi see in the pasuk that happened? Is it just a tradition that Rashi had from his Rebbeim that this is what made him run after her? No! Don't ever accept that when you're reading Rashi. There has to be something in the pasuk, and here's what it is. Now, is this because Schwartz says so? We have 900 years of commentary to Rashi that wrote whole Sfarim dedicated to answering these kind of questions. I can tell you there are three or four different answers to this question, and this is the one that I take the prerogative to place before you as I think the one that fits best. Here's what it is, and it's simple. In the pasuk it says that Avraham's servant went to an area where there were a lot of young women near a well. What were those young women doing near the well? It says in Hebrew, they were all shalavos mayim. It says again, he made a deal with respect to all the girls who went lishov mayim. Now, shin aleph bet in Hebrew means to place a pail into a well with something heavy in it so that when it hits the water, the rock or the heavy thing makes it dip into the water. When the plane of the top dips past the water, you let it drop a little bit and then you wheel it in, and that's called shin aleph bet. Okay? No, just lower the someone must have been doing work here before this. So just lower the sound on. Don't pick it up. Okay. So okay. So all the other girls are shoavos there, right? And then it describes what Rivka is doing. It says, Vahanara Tobas Marema O the Sulabi Shloyada, Vatirid Ha'ayino, Vitamale Kado Vata'al. See what she does? She went down to the well and filled her jar. What does it not say in the pasuk? All the other girls are shit out of betting.
And it says it twice. It just says that she was filling her jug. It doesn't use the shorash shenal of bet when she gets water, like if we mentioned twice for all the other girls. Why? She doesn't have to shenal of bet. Why?
The water is.
Now, if Rashi was sitting here in this room right now, and we'd ask him, we might have better questions to ask him if you only had 5 minutes with Rashi. But if he was sitting here and we asked him, Rashi, do you really believe that historically the water rose into that well like that? I really believe not. First of all, I have to tell you, let's go back 800 years before Rashi. When you read something like that in Medrash Rabbah, or in Maseches Chulin, or in a Gemara, you should know that, what did I just say before? Even if the text had been written that way in the Bible, you have the rationalist commentaries who say, who would explain it away? How much more so when it appears in the Medrash? The Medrash is trying to teach you something deeper. It's not this. Don't take these everything literally. Rambam says if you take these kind of Midrashim literally, it's foolish. But if you deny them and say, Midrashic literature is for little babies, the little Midrash says it's made so you can be happy when we're learning to... That's that Rambam calls that rishus. That could be wicked because we're losing sight of the importance of this Midrash. This Midrash is really profound about the water rising into a pail. The question is, can it simultaneously be profound even as I don't accept that it's true historically? Right? Mm-hmm. I don't believe that rocks fall under Yaakov's head either, and Rashi includes it in his Perush. See, it's easier for me to say that shot in the Medrash Rabbah. Because I can say Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, the Agadah, and the Gemara were written with greater depth. Anyone who's been following the Daf Yomi the last few weeks and reading some of those amazing Agadot in the beginning of Amocheres HaSfina has to obviously feel that these things were not meant at any time to be taken literally. The rabbis would, I must insist, they would be fools to think that we should take it literally. No one, not the Vilna Gaon, not anyone says we should take these stories literally. Right? About sea creatures who have 300 kilometers between their eyes. And, I mean, it's obvious that there's some deeper meaning to these stories. Fine. So what is it for us here? What is Rashi doing here? So Rashi wants to tell us that there was something miraculous about Rivka. Right? Something just amazingly miraculous about Rivka. And at this point, the Mefarshim to Rashi, if you want to say a little more, so now you can get into the realm of a sermon, is if she was so miraculous, why did he have to put it to the test? Why did he have to ask her about water and camels? Of course this girl is for Yitzchak. She's Melumedes Benissim. I see water rising into her belt and she hides it. And she's discreet about it. She's beautiful. She's got everything. This girl's miraculous. The famous drash in this Rashi is, and that's often the pshat. The drash is the pshat. Right? What are we saying? Is that even if the girl is miraculous? Now, what would be the miraculous nature of a girl? Right? You think it depends on the person, I guess. But she's gorgeous. Her father's got money, she's funny, she's witty, she's good conversationalist, she's got everything. But you know what?
Does she have chesed?
If she doesn't have chesed, the shidduch's off. I don't care how miraculous she is, I don't care what the water does. The water is just a metaphor, because water is always a metaphor for marriage. Everyone's meeting at a well. Why that's so, there are a lot of interpretations, but Yaakov meets Rachel well, and Moshe meets Tzipor at a well, and all the shidduchim are made at wells, so fine. But it's a miraculous nature for Rivka. Right? Notice that when Yaakov meets Rachel, he also turns over that stone, something that four men couldn't do. And Moshe saves those ships. There's a transcending chesed that's going on that creates the shidduchim dafka at wells. Right, that's for a different drash. But the point I'm trying to make is that I don't believe you have to feel that even Rashi necessarily believed that the water actually did this. But I do believe that Rashi would say the Torah purposely omitted Shin Aleph Bet from her description in order to give us this impression that she is different than from all the other girls. And it was noticeable and recognizable. Okay? Let me give one other example of this. Of course, Rashbam does not ascribe to any of this. Come on, Betzemeleach. Rashi, you're reading the text too closely. All right? How about this one? When he finally determines that that she did as he said, right? And by the way, this Shabbos morning, my 845 shear is dedicated to asking the question, did she really do as he said? Because if you look carefully, she did not. She did not fulfill his deal. Right, I'll get to that. You'll see it inside. It's not the Beis HaLevi made a big deal about the fact that she did not do exactly as he said. She changed a little bit, and she did better, but she did not exactly do as he said. Yes?
So if the purpose is to test this Midah of Chesed, then why didn't Eliezer wait for her and write to him?
Is it vice versa? I don't know. He can't just say, I'm not sure what he wants or needs. He started off by saying, does anybody have some water? To assume that a strange woman is going to come over to me and say, you look thirsty, can I help you? I'm not sure if that might have been stretching it too much. He would have been stranded. Yeah, he went to her and said, do you have any extra water? Most girls would say, you know, how much water can a girl... let's say she's not three. Let's say she's... One response says she's 14 or 17 or 20. If we have time today, I'm going to ask, why... This is what I forgot to remember having this very conversation with Nechama Leibowitz, and she said, I don't know why Rashi insisted that she's three. She said, I know why the Medrash insists that she's three. I don't know why Rashi went along. I want to try to answer that question before we leave tonight. When the Medrash says she's three, I can read deeper into that. I think that her being three means she was born just as Sarah was dying. Just at the same time Sarah was dying. So Rivka being born just as Sarah is dying is a beautiful message of one matriarch goes, another matriarch comes. Vizarach Hashemesh, Uvah Hashemesh, right? Ad Shelo Shoko, Shimsho Shel Eli, Kvar Zorcho, Shimsho Shel Shmuel. You've heard of those things, right? Like Rabbi Akiva dying on the same year that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is born. Remember I told you at the very first class that the reason why they say Rashi was born in the year 1040 is not because we know that. We don't know what year Rashi was born. We just assume he was born in 1040. He wasn't famous yet, because that's the year that Rabbeinu Gershom died. So they just said, according to this rule, Rivka and Sarah, Rashi must have been born the year Rabbeinu Gershom died. Beautiful. So I'll try to get back to that three. But in the Chanami, it just goes so far with this. But I want to take you to one additional example on this parsha, an extreme example between Rashi and Rashbam. Is where he finally realizes that this girl has been put to the test and she has passed the test. So he gives her 10 gold coins, 2 bracelets, and a nose ring that weighs a beka, beis kuf ayin. And Rashi says it's an amazing thing. He says, if you come with me, a descendant of yours will deliver a decalogue on 2 tablets, and he'll build a mishkan with a donation that the Jews, that the descendants will make with a beka of silver. Wow. It's true, the Torah uses the word beka to describe those donations. There were 10 dibros, and there were 2 luchos. That, Rashi tells us, is what she heard from this servant in order to give her an impetus to join. And when Rashbam read things like this, he said, Rashi, where do you get this? What do you do? You say Anilo Basi Elo Lekshuto Shel Mikra. And when do you do Agodah? What's the important word? Hamiyasheves, to clarify, to appease. I'd rather use to appease. There is an unsettled text here. It needs Yishuv. Help! What needs Yishuv when he gives her 10 gold pieces and 2 bracelets and a nose ring that weighs a beka? What's grabbing you at the throat that says Hamikra Zimra Dersheni? Anyone? Right? Why tell me this specifics? Now you're getting to see the difference between Rashi and Rashbam. Rashbam will say, come on, that's just the way it was. That's what he gave her. It would have said 12 if he gave her 12. Right? He just gave her 10. Rashi says, nah, I'm not satisfied with that. Right. If the Torah just wanted to tell me that he was trying to tell this girl, listen, if you come with me, my master has a lot more of this. There's more where this came from. He's loaded.
Right? Why give
specifics? Just say Natan lo matanos rabos. He gave her much gold and silver. He gave her gifts. Just say he gave her stuff. When the Torah tells me more information than I needed to know to get the message across, Rashi is always going to want to explain why. Now, in none of these cases does Rashi make up something. Rashi quoted the Medrash here. This is a Medrash Rabba, and the 99% of Rashi is nothing but that. The greatness of Rashi is to fit it into the Dabur Deborah of Nov. That's the greatness of Rashi, because Medrash doesn't always do that. Rashi picks and chooses the Midrashim that are Davar Davar Lofnav. In the very first week, if you recall, I gave you some examples of where Rashi specifically rejected Talmudic Agadah or Midrashim that did not fit the Davar Davar Lofnav. Yes?
Doesn't it also fit a pattern and an urge in Rashi to tie the Avos into tradition that wasn't there yet, and they already know the tradition's going to be, and they're already observing Tayag Mitzvah?
Yeah, okay. It's Rashi definitely has other agendas, which is to be a mechaneich. Do you remember the example I gave with the hands coming out of the pocket? Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember that one? So there Rashi wants to be he wants to give you a lesson in life. What we did last week, where Rashi gives a beautiful message about the Gedol HaKnosas Orchim, which is bereft from Rashbam's Perush, etc., etc. So this is really what defines these two is that Rashi wants the text to be more significant, he gets more out of it, and of course, what ends up happening here is that his Perush is more popular. And yet, anytime I would give you a test of, okay, read the pasuk. Don't tell me any drash you know. Just say the pshat. If pshat was your first goal, how would you explain this pasuk? And in the 21st century, unless maybe in Hasidic approach to the Bible, everyone would probably read it like Rashbam. In pshat, I'm saying, no?
Yeah, but his is the pshat that agrees, that is the surface explanation, given the assumption that you have to explain every word that is, you know, any repetition is not just there to be...
Exactly. Am I going to tell you that I read Rashi better than his own grandson who sat on his lap and learned with him? Right? I don't pretend to tell you that. Right? When Rashbam, who is so overly critical of his grandfather, sometimes says things like, anyone who says this parish doesn't know the first thing about pshat, he says that 20, 30 times, and it's Rashi, right? So it's not that Rashbam was against Rashi's drashos. It's not that Rashbam is so critical, both in the Talmud, in some Tzadik Aleph, in the Sechas Chulin, as well as in his parish, about the idea of rocks fighting under Yaakov's head to explain how many rocks become one. Right, it's not a tragedy about two different ways a grandfather and a grandson read text. Rashbam was not against Rashi per se. He was against Rashi claiming to be pshat and instituting these commentaries. Okay, let's continue on. For the bottom of page 1, by Tzitzit Tzua, Banim B'Kirba, we did once before. Top of page 2, 18, 19, 20, we also did. Okay, now source number 22 and 23. See that? The Rashbam text. You see it? Mm-hmm. This is actually some of Lakshin's material. You can see here in this is like Rashbam's introduction to the Torah, so to say, where he complains that in the 11th century people are not studying Bible the way I'd like them to, because they only study the Bible through the eyes of the Talmud. And if you only study the Bible through the eyes of the Talmud, You won't be steeped in pshat. I'm sorry. Now I might have made reference to the 19 letters of Ben Uziel. So in the 18th letter, Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, writing in Germany in the 19th century, blamed the sorry state of the study of Bible in Germany on Rabbeinu Tam. Now, who was Rabbeinu Tam to Rashbam?
Cousin.
Brother. They were brothers. Brother. Yaakov and Shmuel were brothers. Rabbeinu Tam was much younger than Rashbam. And Rabbeinu Tam, in a commentary in Tosfos, in three different Masechtas, says that you don't have to study Tanakh from the Tanakh anymore. You only have to study the Tanakh from the Talmud. Where did he get such a psak? Because the Talmud says that the reason why we refer to the Talmud as the Talmud Bavli, Kishon Bolal Hashem Sfas Kol Aretz, right? Remember in the Migdal Bavel, is because it's a mixture. Bavel originally comes from the word mixture. Talmud Bavli is a mixture of Tanakh, Mishnah, and Talmud. So if the Talmud Bavli is a mixture of Tanakh, so you don't have to study the Tanakh anymore. The Talmud itself says you should divide your day's study into three. A third Tanakh, a third Mishnah, a third Gemara. So now you don't have to study Tanakh anymore. Just open up the Talmud and you'll get all the Tanakh you need. Right? And so Rashi, that's Rabbeinu Tam. It was an amazing dichotomy between brothers. Rashbam complains that people are studying too much Talmud. Read this whole thing in English while I'm talking. People are studying too much Talmud, so they're not in how to study Tanakh. And Rabbeinu Tam said, that's fine, it's perfectly fine, do just that. Okay. Now, I know I'm not up to Spain yet, but if you look at source number 24, it would appear that all of Rashbam's objections to Rashi were shared by Ibn Ezra. This is a very rare book. It's a book called Safa Rura. I was just able to get it from the fourth floor of the Gottesman Library, and they allowed me to make a quick copy. So it says, see there, it writes about the correct approach to studying Talmud, studying the Bible. Now, here's an interesting dichotomy between Rashbam and Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra claims that when Pshat flies in the face of the halacha, you must step down from Pshat. You must always try to fit the Pshat with the halacha. Sounds firm, right? Rashbam didn't care to. Rashbam, in Parshas Mishpatim alone, explains Pshat about 20 times against the halacha. Against a clear halacha. Look, va'avado la'olam, the slave gets his ear pierced, right? He wants to work beyond the 6 years. What does the Torah say? Va'avado la'olam. What does Rashbam say there? Kol yamecha. That's Ibn Ezra, that's Rashi. Kol yamechayav. He works for the rest of his life. That's really difficult, because in that particular case, not only is Rashbam explaining that verse against the halacha, he's pitting Shmos against Vayikra, because in Vayikra, no slave works forever. They all get freed in the Yovel, right? No, Hebrew slaves. So in this way, Ibn Ezra is much more frum than Rashbam. I would say Rashbam could not get a job in teaching the Tanakh and the Yeshiva today. He would not get a job. Maybe a YUE. No, I don't mean that tongue in cheek. I mean, they know who he is, so they'd say, all right, your grandfather was a tzaddik, so. Look, see the next page. Look, I make a living out of teaching Rashbam, so I love him. But this is just a manuscript that shows that it's eminently clear that when Rashi did fail to finish something in the Talmud, that Rashbam took over. And in fact, that's really the scholarship, is the reason why he could get away with writing what appears in here. How could someone so famous as the man who was called upon to finish Rashi in Makos, Psochim, right? Baba Basra, right? Wherever Rashi doesn't finish, Rashbam is called on to, he's the one who takes over, right? How could someone so famous sit in a jar for 800 years? Because it took till the Enlightenment. No one before the Enlightenment would print this stuff. Right? No one's going to print Vayi Erev, Vayi Boker, Yom Echad. You know what I'm talking about? The Jewish day starts in the morning. Right? When we get up to Ibn Ezra, I'm going to show you an amazing poem called Igeres HaShabbos. Have you heard of it? The Sabbath Epistle, where Ibn Ezra felt he needed to write a poem defending Shabbos against the Jews who are keeping it, you ever hear this? From Saturday morning to Sunday morning. Because he said there are Jews who were mistaken about when the day starts. They think the day starts in the morning, and he said, where could Jews get such narishkeit? And what does he blame on? Rashbam's perush too, by Yerevay Boker Yom Echad. So Rashbam, you're so zealous to explain things in Pshat, even when it flew against the halacha, that it caused some damage in the Jewish community. I must say, in Rashbam's defense on this particular example, these communities long predated Rashbam that were doing this. And second of all, Rashbam is correct in Sefer Bereishis, the day does start in the morning. When does the day start at night? The day the Torah was given. Right? The idea of the day starting at night is a Torah law.
How does the Torah start in the morning in Bereishis?
Because when it says, the first page of Talmud asks the question, why does the first Mishnah start Me'emas HaKorin Hashma Ba'arvin? Why does the first Mishnah in Bracha start off with Ma'ariv Kriyat Shema, not Shachar's Kriyat Shema? So the Gemara says, because Vayera Vayipoker, Yom Echod, the day starts with the Erev, right? First page of Talmud tells you this, right? If I slaughter a cow 5 minutes before Shkia, and its calf 5 minutes after Shkia, I have not violated the Torah. But if I slaughter a cow 5 minutes after Shkia, and then 23 hours later, before Shkia, I have violated the Torah. You get my point, right? You're not allowed to slaughter them on the same day. That's the same day, according to the law. But here's the deal. The Rashbam says, you want to teach Vayera Vayipoker that the day starts at night? I don't think so. Close your ears if you're afraid to hear this. Okay. But he says, Vayehi Erev. What? When is it now? Vayehi Erev. Hayo Erev. When is it? Now, evening, right? Vayehi Boker. It became morning. When is it now? It's the morning, right? Vayehi Erev. Day turned to evening. Vayehi Boker. Night turned to morning. Yom Echad. Now day one is over. When is day two starting?
At the end. Okay.
In the morning. So that's Rashbam on, but don't tell me. It looks from here like Rashbam is keeping Shabbos Saturday morning to Sunday morning. Rashbam would say, Chas v'shalom, don't get me wrong here. I don't want anyone to determine halacha for my perush. He probably might not have ever even written this to be read. He just wanted to say, listen, I have to explain the biblical text according to Pshat. I wouldn't have even written such a perush if my grandfather had done a better job of explaining Pshat, but he didn't. Rabbeinu Tam, his brother, was asked also to write a perush on the Torah, perhaps to soften the blow of this Pshat. And he said, no, I don't need to write a perush. My grandfather already wrote the perush. No one else needs to write any other. Nonetheless, Rashbam...
Ibn Ezra
and Rashbam were 4 years apart. One was born in 1085, one was born in 1089. Ibn Ezra traveled the world. Rashbam was in France. So Ibn Ezra was originally in Spain.
Was Rashbam in Troyes also?
Remember, there was a lot of upheaval then with the Jewish community, so his life was in France. But I'll tell you this, is that Rashbam would tell you that it's, I'm not saying when to how to keep Shabbos from my pshat and my perush, but I would tell you this: it's not the pshat of Vayera Vayipoker that says when to keep Shabbos; it's the drash of Vayera Vayipoker that tells us when to keep Shabbos. And my perush is pshat. Don't keep Shabbos from my perush. All right. Now, finally, what we see from source number 32 on this: this is a very rare manuscript of Rashi to Iyov. Because while most people can tell you that Rashi dies or doesn't finish certain Masechtos and Rashbam takes over, it's not as clear to people that Rashi also died while before he had a chance to finish Iyov. I'll let you in another secret the scholars say, is that Rashi did not write the perush attributed to him on Divrei HaYamim. There are a number of proofs to this, not least of which is probably the best proof, is that in Rashi's perush, the Divrei HaYamim, it quotes Rashi often. Okay? So that be right. Rashi never quotes Rashi in any other book or in any other Masechta, but in Divrei HaYamim he does. Plus, he disagrees quite often with Rashi and Malachim. Remember, Divrei HaYamim is parallel to Malachim. So things Rashi says in Malachim are parallel to Sukkim, he takes issue with. Plus, this is less of a proof, but it's an interesting proof, is that the Radak, in his introduction to Divrei HaYamim, writes, to this day there is no perush to Divrei HaYamim that is a significant perush that you can study, so I have to write it. That was 200 years after Rashi. If Rashi had written a perush to Divrei HaYamim, someone like the Radak would have known it. It would have been as famous as all of other Rashi's works. So there is a perush that's attributed to Rashi, which seems to come out of the school of Rashi. It seems to be some French approach, but it's clearly not Rashi. And he did not finish his perush to Iyov. In the standard Mikros Gedolos, if you look at the very top of the page, in the top line in the left column, it says, I underlined it, it says, Ad kan yosad Rashi, mikan va'ilach, eino loshon Rashi. This doesn't tell you what...
This is 32?
It's 31. Yeah. This doesn't tell you what I get from the Talmud, which is, who is the loshon now? Who's taking over? This is the topic of a number of doctoral pieces over the years, in the last 30, 40 years, over whether it's Rabbi Yosef Kara, whether it's Rashbam, whether it's Rabbeinu Yaakov, whether it's some kind of conglomeration of these, which I think is the correct answer. There is a, when I took a course called Northern French Parshanut to the Book of Iyov back in graduate school. It wasn't just Iyov, and it wasn't just Parshanut to Iyov. It was Northern French, not Southern French, but Northern French commentaries to the Book of Iyov. And so I remember writing a paper that in that course, which the professor published a little piece of it in an article he was writing on the topic, which was based on the following. The end of Iyov talks a lot about the Leviathan, the Leviathan, the snake that God will one day conquer. Right? Now, to try to determine that those comments belong to Rashbam is very difficult. Who quotes an out-of-the-way Perush in my contemporary writings? So there's a book called Sefer Nitzachon that collects three or four comments of Rashbam, and based on those three or four comments, some scholars have concluded that this is really Rashbam. So I posited in this paper that, wait a second, Rashbam certainly is the commentary to Bava Basra. Right? That we know. It's one of few mesechtas that we have a commentary of Rashbam. And what is the middle of Bava Basra spends two pages on? I alluded to these boat stories before with these large fish, large sea creatures.
Leviathan.
Ayin Dal 9a in Mesechus Bava Basra is all about the Leviathan. Two whole huge pages, great material, four sides of Talmud where Rashbam is commenting on Leviathan. So let's see if that matches what's in the Farish. And it did match. Right? So that's a good proof that it's Rashbam who's taking over. But better than this, look at this manuscript that this professor found. It says, we'll try to read it together. Kashem Shebaal.
What number?
32.
Okay. Forget that word. Hashem, it's about the owner of a field. Yodea Zman, what is it? Yodea Zman Lekitata Velokta Kita. Kach yoda HaKadosh Baruch Hu Zmano Shal Rabbeinu Shlomo Ulekacho Be'ito Lachniso B'Yeshiva Shamala. Okay? Just as the owner of a field knows when to pick the dates and the grapes in his vineyard, or in his pardes, so too God knew exactly when to pick the fruit of Rashi and to take him into the Gan Eden to the Yeshiva Shamal. And it says, Mikan va'elach pirosh. Now take a look at the second column there. Mikan va'elach pirosh ben bito Rabbeinu Shmuel Hazokain. Right, you see that? So that would be, that means of Shmuel Hazokain, that means that at the time that this is written, Rashbam is already quite old himself. And already. Another important thing is that Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam both lived into their 90s.
Wow.
Which means they had a tremendous influence on Ashkenazic Jewry. Wow. The first generation Bali HaTos was a huge, huge influence just by the sheer age of how far they've spanned when most people are dying at 40, 50, 60, and they just spanned a huge amount of time. And they could either give us Yechus, Achiv Shal Rabbeinu Yaakov, that's Rabbeinu Tam, Achiv Shal Rabbeinu Yitzchok, it was a very prolific Torah family. So what we see from this source is that this is Saviyar is saying that not only does Rashbam take over for Rashi in the Talmud, Rashbam takes over for Rashi, not Rabbeinu Tam, not the Ri, right? But Rashbam takes over for Rashi in Tanakh as well. It was assumed that he would be the next Rashi. And I'm sorry to say, it didn't happen. You know, we can open now, we take it for granted, but of course it also is Rashbam. I'm sorry, that was only from 1905. In all those years, you couldn't get a Rashbam. You had to go to a Ksav Yad, a library that just had the manuscript. You'd have to, get your hands on something like I've shown you, something like this, right? These original Kisvei Yad of Rashbam, right? So just a copy, but in order to see what he wrote, why didn't Rashbam end up being the future of Rashi? So some say because he was too critical, especially in the beginning of Bereishis. In fact, open up in Mikros Gedolos, in the beginning of Bereishis, know what you'll find? No Rashbam at all. He's not found in Parshas Bereishis, Noach, and Lech Lecha. Because he's so critical of Rashi in those three, they just said, no, that's just... We'll spank him a little and keep it out of the habit. I mean, it's just amazing. You won't find it. Go look. But also at the end of the Torah, there's no Rashbam, Hazinu, and Zosfracha. But I just want to conclude with one thing. If we got finished saying about something about Rashi, that Rashi wanted to squeeze every single ounce of text out of the Bible, and that's what made it so popular, I would like to show that Rashi didn't just talk the talk. Look at this last parish here. I've spoken about this from the pulpit, so if it's possible you'll remember the Inyan. But Rashi makes a great point of describing all of the appurtenances of the tabernacle and all of the vestments of the Kohen Gadol at great length. Incidentally, I think I mentioned this last week, Rashbam introduces this parsha by saying, I have nothing to say about the tabernacle. There is nothing in human experience that can explain the intricacies of the tabernacle. Read my grandfather's Perush. It can only be explained in Drash. He says the same thing about sacrifice. He says the same thing about ritual purity. He says the same thing about the laws of Tzaraas. I guess that's part of ritual purity. And he says there are some things that human experience, very important word for Rashbam, Derech Eretz, human experience Rashbam used last week, remember, to explain the babies fighting inside of Rivka. Remember that?
Right.
Human experience. Women who carry twins. It feels like, right? Rashi said, no, they're fighting over this way, that way, right? So Rashbam likes to use human experience, but there's no human experience to explain the tabernacle. Incidentally, on the tabernacle, Ibn Ezra, the Spanish counterpart, who are brothers in arms when it comes to their objections to Rashi, but when it comes to a lot of other things, you'll learn starting when we do Sparta commentaries, are miles apart. Ibn Ezra is a mad scientist when it comes to explaining the tabernacle. He uses such Kabbalah and Zohar, and you cannot believe what Ibn Ezra turns into when describing things that Rashbam felt there is no pshat. Ibn Ezra devolves into, forget about Drash, he goes into Torah Tassod and Hasidish stuff that you can't believe. Huge, huge comments, especially in Sefer Shmos. We'll get to that, why Shmos is different when we do Ibn Ezra. Finally, this leads to this last commentary, source number 34. When describing the linen ephod that the Kohen Gadol wears in front of his garment, you're probably familiar with the sight, right? It looks like an apron. Right? A pratzint. Right? So Rashi comments that he says, Lo shamati v'lo matzati b'braisa perush tavnisa. That when he says in the braisa, there's something called braisa de malechas hamishkan, which we don't have today, which Rashi cites about 40 times in Sefer Shmos to describe different items in the Mishkan. It's called braisa de malechas hamishkan. And he had descriptions of everything in the Mishkan in this collection, yeah. And it says that that Brisa describes everything in the Mishkan, but not the ephod. So he says, "V'libi omerli," my heart tells me something. And in the book I described to you called Heichal Rashi, which is like an anthology of the stories of Rashi, it tells a story that when he was 15 years old, leaving the yeshiva in Cologne. When he was already about 8 years old, they said, you have to leave France. All the Rebbeim here have taught you everything they know. You know too much already. Go learn in a different yeshiva. He went to Germany to learn with bigger Rabbanim, and when he was 15, by the time he's coming back, he's already ready to become Rashi. He's 15, he's leaving the yeshiva, and he's watching these girls ride on horses. Watching these women, on these officers, these princesses, riding on their horses. And he's transfixed with them. He can't stop looking at them. And he was so bothered by this that he told a friend, and that's how we know this. This friend wrote it down someplace, and it became a legend of Rashi. That Rashi could not stop looking at these women. Because at this time, you should see in the writings of Hasidei Ashkenaz, Sofer Benoshim is a big no-no for Yeshiva Bachar. When you want to get married, you look at your kala, and you look at her. But otherwise, you should not stare at a woman. So Rashi was very, very upset with this, and he confessed it to a friend. And that's the end of that. Here, look what he writes in his commentary. My heart tells me, what is this linen ephod? Shehu chagur lo me'acharav rochbo kirochav gavish, kimin sino shekorin protsint balaz, shechagrot hasarot kishirov chot ala susim. What my heart tells me, see the English, is that what the ephod is, looks like what those women wear when they're riding their horses. How could he know that? Maybe he saw it in the book. But I think it's more that he saw it with his own eyes, and he was transfixed with him, and that's what he writes. The only time in his commentary he writes, "Believe merely, my heart tells me." Why do you have to say that? Just say, "Believe near it." It appears to me. What does he have to say? "Believe merely, my heart tells me." My heart tells me that that's why I saw that. So Rashi walks the walk. He not only does not waste a single speck of Torah, he didn't waste a single speck of his life. Everything made sense. Everything fit. Right? Okay. Remember once Rashi's wife was going, they were going to a wedding together, and she tried on a new dress, and she said, "So Rashi, what do you think of my new dress?" And he says, "I don't know, it's a little big on you." He goes, "Must you comment on everything?" We're married now, guys. That's good.